Welcome back, and I am here with a man who I am just now getting to know in person, but he's been somebody who I've known really all my life as a football fan. From the 70s and even in the 60s, the 60s and 70s, everybody knows a guy by the name of Fred Biletnikoff. He's number 25, former Oakland Raider, wide receiver, NFL superstar. He's now here, joined our show today. How you doing, Fred?
On this side of the grass, that's what I'm happy about. But it's good to be here with you, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I am so proud. I was just talking earlier about how nervous I was today to have one of my childhood idols now share the show with me for today. So can we get to, maybe we'll do a little reflection to start off with.
Okay.
Take us back in time to you joining the NFL, getting drafted. What was it like back then to be, a wide receiver in the NFL?
Well, back in, if you're ready for, back in 65, okay, whenever that was, they had both the AFL and NFL. And so the AFL was a young lead, included, you know, Oakland, San Diego, Denver, Miami, that whole group, a great era of football. And they had the old guard, which was the NFL. And so I got drafted by Detroit and by the Raiders. But me being from Erie, Pennsylvania, no slight against Erie, Pennsylvania, but I had the opportunity to come either to California or go to Detroit, Michigan. So I decided to come to California. So at that time, you know, you were just happy to get drafted. There was very little media. The only thing that was going on at that period of time was the fact that there was a big conflict between the NFL and AFL getting players. And that was really the media hype at that time, which was very, very, very small across the country. But that's the period of time I came and got drafted. And, you know, it was more like now, you know, people plan to get drafted. They want to go to one team. If they don't want to go to one team, they refuse to go and they send them to another team. And they're on TV and they're on media, you know, for an entire week. But back then, there was very little hoopla. You know,
so you were proud to be an Oakland Raider, and then as the leagues ended up coming together, how did things change?
Well, things changed from a standpoint that we were the league that did a lot of passing. We were throwing the ball 40 to 60 times a game, and that was the attraction to get players to come to the AFL. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to sign with Oakland, and that's what really turned the tide for us because we were always the late game in the afternoon, back east especially. Mm-hmm. And even though we're playing 1 o'clock here, it's 4 o'clock back there. The NFL was already done for the day. And so the attraction was seeing a team throwing the ball 40, 50 times a game. And all of a sudden, it just took off. You know, everybody in that period of time in the AFL got to be so recognizable because we were on such a prime time back east for people to see. So that's how the notoriety with the AFL really got started because of that.
Yeah, thinking back to your football cards, I was trying to reimagine them a little bit. You had long hair. This was, I'm thinking, like in the 70s.
I was anti-establishment, absolutely.
Is that how you were? Okay, describe you. What kind of person were you? What kind of young person were you? And what kind of, tell us about the game of football back then, maybe how it changed.
Well, you know, first of all, I go from Erie, Pennsylvania down to the deep south in Tallahassee, Florida. Florida, okay, with the crew cut and everything else like that. And then when I came out to Oakland, I came out in the hippie period.
Right.
So everybody's, hell, let's grow, let the hair grow. And that was it. That's how that got started. But football in Oakland at that period of time was great because of the fact that, you know, we played in the old stadium when I first was a rookie, Yule Field. And then we moved into the Oakland Coliseum, which was one of the state-of-the-art facilities in the league at that time. And the people were fantastic. They were just crazy about football. And we gave them a good product. We gave them good football. We played with a lot of passion. We were a team that Al liked to bring around that were underdogs, that came from tough backgrounds, from small schools that nobody really heard about or didn't see very much. And we were that type of group of guys that all we wanted to do was play football. And that's who we wanted on this team.
So the players, the Raiders today are known as sort of the bad boys of the NFL. What were you known as back then? Was it similar?
hide to women and children. No, we were known as a good, tough physical group that, you know, when you played against us, you were in for a battle, and we had the players to back it up. And we had the skill positions, the physical guys. We had so much talent on a team for a good period of time. I played 14 years, and, you know, the majority of us played together at least 10, 12 years on one team. So we had a good group of guys that were tough. You know, they were a tough group coming in. And because of the way Al was, he blended us all together. And believe it or not, we all got along together well, even from being from, you know, different backgrounds, different situations in our life, if it was good or bad or whatever it may be. You know, he brought us together as a group, and all we want to do is play football.
So who was your best friend on the team? Did you have one?
Kenny Stabler.
I can imagine. Yeah. He's delivering the ball to you.
He just passed away a few years ago. I thought I'd go before him, but he beat me to it. But Kenny and Pete Banaszak were the guys that were my best friends. So Pete still lives in Florida. So, you know, Kenny and I were really close. We lived together for 3 years when we were going through divorces and that type of thing, which was pretty interesting for 3 years living together. But
give us a story.
You want one? Well, I'll put it to you. I bought a bar in Oakland on Hagenberger Road called The Flanker. And
great name.
Kenny at that time wasn't starting. Daryl LaMonica was still on the team, and he was a starter. Mm-hmm. And Kenny being so competitive and talent-wise and everything, just a great guy. I think the world of Kenny. We were in the bar one night drinking, and it was a Friday before our game Sunday at home. And a bunch of Daryl's friends were in there, and they started drinking, and Kenny and I were eating dinner, and one came over to the table and started getting in Kenny's face about he was a LaMonica fan and back and forth, so he goes, sits down, comes back, and Kenny looks at me, and Kenny hits him, knocks him over the table.
Whoa.
And I go, Snake, we got to get out of here. So we run to the back where I had my car parked, go in the back. By the time we got in a car, we're coming out on Hagenberger Road at the stop sign. Two cop cars were coming around the corner. And so we took off, headed back to home where we were living in Alameda. And I looked at him. I go, what the hell are you doing? He goes, you know, son, you just don't need people like that in your bar. And that was the answer to it all.
Oh,
so we never got, nothing ever happened about it. But that's the way Kenny was, and that's the way we hung out. We did a lot of things. There's a lot of stories.
I can imagine. So as a kid, you know, I remember playing, you know, I played football through high school. But even as a little kid, one of us would be Stabler, usually obviously the quarterback, if we had a lefty, and the other one would be Biletnikoff, right? And we'd pretend we were you. So I'm thinking, like, if putting myself in your shoes, who did you look up to? Did you have idols, or were there NFL greats that were like, wow, those are the ones that I wanted to emulate?
A guy, Tommy McDonald. From Philadelphia Eagles, being born in Erie, Pennsylvania, and Cleveland, it was Cleveland or Pittsburgh. Well, my favorite was Tommy McDonald, because, you know, that time you still had black and white TV, but you still got the Eagles games.
Okay.
And so I loved just the way Tommy played, and I got his number, just be 25, just because he wore the number. So that's the number I was able to wear all the time. And so he was my hero, and he just passed away. He's in the Hall of Fame. And every time I'd see him back there every year, I said, Tommy, I need a jersey. I've been asking you for years. He goes, get the hell out of here. He said, quit pulling my leg about that. I said, no, seriously. And I told him the story. He never believed me, though.
Were you were talking to him
at the Hall of Fame celebration?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So you entered the Hall of Fame in what year?
88.
Okay. Now, being in that group, the emotion.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's just, you know, it's a team you can't ever get cut from, number one. You're in there for life. It's like going down to, you know, in the afternoon on Saturday, whatever, you go down to the bar, you meet your friends that hang out, watch football games or whatever, and just spend the day together. That's what it's like at the Hall of Fame with all the guys. Even though we played against each other, competed against each other tremendously, okay, and really viciously, and now we're just all good friends.
So football, it's a violent sport. It was different back in the day. I mean, you played at a time where the helmets looked a lot different. Maybe face masks were a lot different. But I mean, the game has changed. What's your sense on the way the game has changed? Obviously, it's still a violent sport.
Well, it's changed to me. It's changed this way. Years ago, the period of time when I came into football, every team had established the type of a game they were going to play offensively and defensively, and you had to fit into the system. Nowadays, high schools, junior colleges, all the way into professional football basically have similar offenses. So the transition from when I came into football was great, and now that transition for kids, it's from high school to college, from college to professional football, isn't that much of a transit.
Okay.
You know, it's just so much, I don't want to say easier, but all you have to do is really have the mental capacity and be strong enough physically and everything to go out there and talent-wise to play football.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that, as entrepreneurs, right, it's our show is about helping people to achieve success in entrepreneurship, so we do that somewhat through telling stories of people who are successful. But I want to sort of talk about a winning mindset, because obviously you've had a lot of wins in your life. I mean, if I was to ask you keys to developing that winning mindset, I mean, I'm kind of curious as to your thoughts on what separates the successful from the elite or the ultra-successful like yourself.
Well, number one, you have to be committed to what you want to do. You know, so if no matter what you, if it's sports, a business, whatever it may be, you know, number one, you got to make a commitment, and that's the big thing. And then along with the commitment, it's how devoted you are and how involved you are, whatever you're doing. You know, like our foundation, very devoted and loyal to our foundation, mm-hmm. very committed to it, and that's what I've always learned over the years. You know, you have the commitment. You have to be devoted to what you're doing, number one. And number two, you have to have a lot of great people around you. And you have to have a lot of honest people around you. And you have to have people that share your same vision. And if you don't have that surrounding you, then it can go in any direction, and you're always gathering everybody in. So instead of working towards a goal, you're working to try to keep the group together to work towards the goal. So it just becomes more maintenance. Mm-hmm. So it's really surrounding yourself by a lot of great people and good people that really want to do what your vision is.
Well, I see it in young people. I see it in at any age. Sometimes we don't put the right people in our lives. Were there times where you made mistakes about who you put in your life?
I made a lot of mistakes. I wish my professional life was like my personal life.
Okay, give me a story of a mistake. Let's hear a story.
Well, I won't give you a mistake. I mean, you make a lot of mistakes. It's just, you know, how you rebound from those mistakes. You know, if you want to keep going on and on, because, listen, every day there's going to be mistakes made, no matter what. I don't care who you are or what you are. There's going to be things that you regret doing that you wish you would have been able to do better by the end of the day. And you really have to come back and bounce back from that in order to really be and go ahead and keep going forward. If your picture in life is dwelling in something, it's never going to work. You know, you got to keep moving forward. If you start going backward, it's a big fall.
So I sold my businesses a number of years ago. I talk to entrepreneurs a lot that have an exit of some kind, and then some of them retire and sort of fade off into the into the sunset, and others they can't quite put it down. They can't quite stop. So I'm thinking an NFL player who's achieved these highest peaks in success, and then one day you decide to hang it up and retire. What was it like trying to shut it off, or did you shut it off?
Well, it took me a couple years to when I mean, you know, I spent basically 15 years playing football, and that was my life, and that was my schedule, and that's what my life was based around. Unfortunately, a lot of people around me got hurt by it. You know, but that's how devoted and loyal I was to football. That's what I wanted to do. And after I got retired from football, professional football, it took me about 2 years to get used to, number one, what am I going to do now? Number two, you didn't make a whole hell of a lot of money, you know, so now you got to go out and get a job. You got to start working. And so now all of a sudden you're put in that position because the retirement is very small, as you know, you've been around and listened. So that's the whole thing. You got to restart again.
Yeah.
You got to restart your life again. You know, you had that. Yeah. Hey, listen, you walked in that stadium, you had all those good times and running around and catching balls and having success and winning games and traveling all over the country. And now it's all over.
Yeah.
And the sooner you realize that, which is tough, you know, which is really, really tough, because it's not like you left football and you're retiring now. You know, you have a retirement built up and all that. You know, it's not that way. You know, it's like you're, 36, 37 years old.
You got to go start another business.
You got to start all over again. Yeah. You're not 23 anymore.
And for you, that meant coaching? What was your next phase?
I went into coaching. And I still did some speaking engagements, some signings, memorabilia stuff, mm-hmm. and, you know, all that type of thing, and appearance-wise, and did that, monkeyed around with that for a couple of years. And then I got into high school coaching, junior college. Then I went to the old USFL. And then I went to Canadian League, and then I ended up with the Raiders. So,
was there anything, at what point did another career just grab a hold of you and say, okay, this is my next chance or my next big opportunity, or has it?
Well, I like coaching. You know, I did a few other things while I was in high school and in junior college for a number of years. You know, I worked for a cleaning service, window cleaning service, had my own pressure washing company. Did all that, and then a friend of mine got the job in Canada, so I dropped everything and went to Canada, and that's how I really started with that.
Okay.
You know, I coached a couple years in USFL, and that worked out really well, so I really like coaching a lot. You know, the only drawback to coaching is it's a tough business. You know, I just spent the 18 years with just the Raiders, not counting the previous years with the, you know, in Canadian League, USFL, all of that, you know, so I've been in a number of years, and it's, you're only good as the players. You know, if you don't have the players, I don't care how great you are coaching, you know, people can call these guys genius. He's going to be in a Hall of Fame coach and all that. If you don't have those guys to play for you, and you gotta treat these kids really well, and you gotta really understand them. That was a great thing with John Madden, you know, with the group he had for 10 years, the way we were, he had to handle multiple personalities, which he did. And he handled us all separately, individually. He knew what we were like. And he had a great opportunity because we're also outstanding players.
Right. You have these people who have had all this success already. Yeah. Now you have to get these personalities, we'll call it. There's probably some ego in that.
Yeah. And, so football, I like the coaching part, you know, then... You know, with the Raiders, and it just, after 18 years with the Raiders, you know, I got out alive, number one. Okay. Yeah. I learned a lot working for Al, not only playing for Al, but working for Al. You know, I learned one thing. If you don't do your job, you're not going to have a job. And if you don't dedicate yourself and be there and be prepared, then you're not going to be around. And that was both playing and coaching for him. Coaching was worse than playing for Al. Yeah.
Okay. Why?
When I first started, Al was the head coach when I was a rookie, and my first preseason experience with Al, we're up in Salt Lake City. We're playing against Denver. Tom Flores was our quarterback, and Lee Groskrupp was our backup guy, and so. When you were the young guys, you never played till the second half, the third and fourth quarter. So I was playing with Lee Groskrupp, and the third quarter, I dropped three balls. Nobody really said anything. Okay. The fourth quarter, I drop a ball. And then towards the end of the fourth quarter, I catch a touchdown pass from Lee. And so I'm coming off the side. I figure, I feel pretty good about myself. So I'm going by Al. He goes, I don't even know why the hell I drafted you.
So that
was my first experience in professional football.
I didn't know Fred Blitnikoff had ever dropped a pass. This is like news to me.
Well, you know what it taught me? It was like this. There's the old adage when Bear Bryant was in Alabama, Kenny was telling me, he said one of the big big alumni guys came up to Bear Bryant just out of the blue and said, you know, how come my son isn't playing? And Bear Bryant looked at him and said, little Johnny just ain't good enough to play with Alabama.
Yeah.
And when I walked off that sideline and Al said that to me, and it's like, hey, stud, you better stud up or if you want to play this game. Yeah, that just ain't good enough.
Yeah. Well, you talked earlier about commitment and winning and, you know, what it takes from a mindset standpoint. So I can only imagine the kind of dedication that it takes to reach those high levels in a game so competitive. But you said earlier that along the way people can get hurt. What did you mean? Or maybe even people got hurt when you were playing.
I'm talking about
the people around you. Well, is that friends?
Well, you know what? I'm not trying to glance that off in any way. It's the fact that, you know, when you're involved in something professional, and if you want to be the best, it all depends how you want to approach it. And number one thing that when you get involved with something that you really want to be the best at, you don't realize the sacrifices you have to make. Then all of a sudden, you realize the sacrifices that you have to make. So people around me at that period, for a good period of time, because I was married twice before, I made the sacrifice family for football. And that's just how I was, and that's how it was. And fortunately enough, I'm still friends with my children. The ex-wives know, but anyway.
any regrets?
You know, no. You know, because if I start looking back at my life with regrets, it just doesn't fit into my personality or what. You know, I made a decision. I lived with decision. I still live with that decision to this day.
What was your proudest moment?
Winning the Super Bowl, and for this reason. I mean, there are a lot of good moments I had playing professional football that I was very fortunate to have. But when I first came into the league, there were a group of guys that the NFL basically threw out, cut, and everything, and the AFL was picking up all those guys. We had a bunch of those guys that played in the NFL, and they let them go, and Al picked them up, and they played. I played with them for 4 or 5 years. A lot of those guys took me under their wing. They were a lot older than I was, and they really helped me out a lot. And so going to the Super Bowl, my first thought when we went to the Super Bowl was thinking about all those old guys that helped me out and how they weren't there to be part of everything, you know. So it was an emotional time for me.
Yeah. Thinking about at your age now, you're in your early 70s, 70?
I just turned 76. How the hell I got to 76, I have no idea.
Okay, so you're 76. You look back at your life with your proud moments, and I'm so happy to hear, you know, as I look at someone your age, you know, I'll be there soon enough and wondering, you know, just what it's like to look back at life. I mean, moving forward in life, I mean, what are the things that you're excited about today? Is there still a passion for achievement like there once was, or does that fade at some stage?
No, you know, there's a lot of things we do. Like I'm really proud of how we've run our foundation. You know, we do it for a great cause to help young girls, you know, adolescent girls get through a period of time in their life that they see as hopeless. We get a lot of, we deal with high risk girls. And to see them go through a drug rehab program, my daughter went through it. That's how it all got started. And, to see my daughter go through it and be successful and then end up in tragedy for her, which is, you know, the whole story. But to see these girls now over here at Tracy's Place of Hope in Loomis is really good, because you see them when they first come in, because we get to meet all of them. A lot of them are, they transition through the house. There's six in a house at a time. And there might be four that are still in the program. Two might have left. Two new ones come in. Two new young ladies come in. And you see what their demeanor is. You see how they are. They're very quiet. They don't smile very much. But then after about 30 days, when you get to visit and see them again, you could see them changing. You could see the personality changing. You could see the reason that they're finally figuring out why they're there, and that there is somebody that cares for them. It's like we're a hands-on foundation. Angela and I are the only ones that run the foundation. Everything goes through us. We don't have a big whole administrative deal. Okay, we don't believe in that. Okay, so we're hands-on. The girls love that. So when they see somebody coming by that's from the foundation, it's either Angela or I, or both of us. So that's very impressive to them, because now they know they're not dealing with just somebody that has a foundation that, okay, we'll see you next year, you know, something like that. It happens all the time. And so I'm very, very proud of that. It's like my daughter told me, she's never going to get her life back again through high school because she was an alcoholic, drug addict. She's never, ever going to get those years back, ever. And all she can do is move forward. And that's what these girls do. And with us, with our foundation, we're really proud of the fact that we've been able to raise money. I mean, we've been going now for 20 years, and we've helped a lot of girls, and we still hear back from a lot of girls. A lot of girls come to our event. A lot of girls help us with our fundraising. A lot of girls have visited the girls in the Tracy's Place of Hope. So we have a group of alumni girls that have gone through the program.
Can you tell us about Tracy? What happened?
Well, Tracy went into a drug rehab program in the South Bay in San Francisco, outside of San Francisco, when she was 19. She was the youngest one in a program. And it's a residential program. It was one of the strictest programs that we felt that she needed to go to, that she finally really wanted to go to, because she was the first one that made the first step that she had to get clean and sober, because the direction she was going in it was a lost cause. So she went into the program. I remember driving
her. This is your daughter. She's a rebellious teen type.
Yeah, and then driving over there, when I first took her over to get admitted and go into the program, all the way over, I'm only going 30 days. I'm going, Trace, all right, do the 30 days. We'll see where we're at from there. Okay. But I'm not doing more than 30 days. I said, Trace, just shut up. Okay, just go see what it is. 30 went to 60 to 90. Yeah, after a while, it was into 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then after that.
And transformation happened?
Oh, it was unbelievable. You know, she was very dedicated to the program, totally stayed away from drinking and drugs, never relapsed at all, ever. And that's why I'm really proud of, being able to sit down and talk with the girls here at Tracy's Place in Loomis. Because they all know her history, because we make sure that they're really knowledgeable about why we started the foundation. And then with Tracy, when she was during that period of time, her first 2 years, and then the following year, a lot of the ladies in the program were older than her, so they all had children. So Tracy did a lot of babysitting, even for some of the kids that were like 13, 14 years old, and helping the ladies out. But the program, the Women's Recovery Association, didn't have an adolescent program for girls. So that's what she was always telling us. She wanted to really see an adolescent program. So we started the first one over there that lasted 10 years. And then because of funding with the state and everything, we had to end the program. But prior to that, what happened with Tracy, with her going over there and helping as a counselor, there was a gentleman that she was friends with from the men's program, and he relapsed. So she went to see him and have a discussion with him at the social club that they have, where they had their socializing, different events there all the time. And so he asked somebody to bring her back to the office. He wanted to talk with her. So she went back to the office, and I guess nobody really knows what happened, and he strangled her and killed her. And then just threw her in a van and then dumped her body at Kenyatta College, and she was found 2 days later. So from that, we had to go through a whole trial and everything like that. Then a few years later, we had to go through a retrial. So we got beat up pretty good, you know. So it was a, if you wanted to have an experience, which you never really want to wish an experience like that on anybody, believe me. But the one thing we found out, the one thing we knew, was that through Tracy, everybody had a chance. These kids have a shot. And like when we sit down and have a chance to visit with the girls here, even years ago with the girls over in the South Bay, is that all we can do is give you a chance, help give you a chance. You know, we're going to make it as comfortable as we can possibly make it for you. Heck, the house that we rebuilt and tore down here and the house we had over in the South Bay, I'd move in there. I'd love it. That's how, and Angela handled all the decorating and everything else with it and did everything. And the girls can feel at home. They can feel that it's a safe place. It's a place that they, which many of them hardly have ever had, is a home. And, you know, you don't realize that till you start sitting down and talking to these girls on their life, where they came from, what it was like. And it's ugly. And it's not only the drugs and the alcohol. It's what they have to put up personally other than that, besides that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is really, it's, these girls go through some ugly things in life, and it's shocking.
So you and your wife operate this foundation. I'm wondering what we can do to help, what I personally can do to help. Obviously, there's a, it's a nonprofit of sorts. How do we get involved? Is there a way to get involved?
Oh, sure. You know, you, well, you have Angela's information. She's always doing things. We have our golf tournament down at Ruby Hill in Pleasanton this year, May 6th, which is our, I believe, our 19th year with our golf tournament. And then we have a crab feed every November. It depends on when in November, usually the first week in November on a Friday night. And then in September 28th, she's going to do, William Jessup is helping us out, and we're going to have a 5K run.
Nice.
A run for life, which would be for domestic violence. And so this will be our first year with that. So Angela's working on that and the golf tournament. So, yeah, you know, people can go on our website, woodplanetcoff.org. Yeah. And we're always looking for volunteers. We're always looking for people that want to help in some way or whatever way they possibly can. And they'll enjoy it. We have a great group of volunteers. And we always refer to Angela as the general, all right, and a well-deserved name.
Okay.
All right. And I wouldn't want to be the convict with the bloodhound after me if it's Angela, all right? But we tease her a lot. But she does a great job. She's very dedicated. That's her job year-round, 12 months out of the year, and I'm just on call.
All right. So I'll kind of tend to wrap up here as we think about winning. I'm so happy to hear that in the mid-70s, we can still have this, passion to achieve, passion to build things, passion to make a difference. Because a lot of guys at my age, I'm in my mid-50s, are thinking retirement and, you know, go to the rocking chair or just golf. And so I find myself wanting to achieve, and I think wanting to do something special too. And I'm so thinking about that for these people that are out here maybe listening, thinking about on the business side, wanting to build businesses and wanting to build something very, very special. I'm wondering, it's so easy to get distracted, and in order to be great, there really is this intense focus. So I guess, how did you decide to go all in on football, or all, now it's all in, it sounds like, on this organization? Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and ditching the other distractions, because someone like Fred Biletnikoff, you have so many choices, right? At some point success brings on a lot of options, but you've found a way to focus.
Well, there really is a time where, you know, like getting out of football, especially, you know, from playing then out of coaching, you have to have some type of direction. You have to have some reason to get up every morning for, number one. It's like yesterday I went to Granite Bay High School, had a nice session with the kids over at Granite Bay, and talked about everything and a lot about life. And doing something like that, doing what we do as a foundation, gives you a purpose back in life again. You know, something that years ago, you never even thought you would do something like this, but we took a tragedy and turned it into something positive. And that was work. And we've made it a success. And we've gone forward with everything. And we are always looking to make things better for other people. And we're always looking to help, you know, the kids, the teenage kids, improve their life. And whatever we could do, whatever program we could be part of, whatever, anything that we could participate in that involves kids, you know, teenagers, we're happy to do it. And we know, because we've had the experience and we've seen it and we've seen the success, we've seen the start, and we've seen what it could do if you really dedicate yourself to really wanting to get back your life.
Yeah. Fred Biletnikoff, I want to thank you. It's been an honor. I could talk to you all day long about football. But as you know, there's a limited amount of time. But I am so respectful of what success really looks like. Me getting a firsthand feel of that is quite an honor.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Believe me, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care of that shirt.
Okay. Right. Yes, he's pointing to my Oakland Raiders shirt that I work out in.
Don't wash it
too
many times.
It's a throwback. Yeah, it's only got a few more washings left. Maybe I'll ask you to sign it if you're up for it. Thank you, Fred. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much for having me on, Mark. Thanks.
You bet. Thanks.